The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. And welcome to the show this evening. Currency a little softer on the day. Commodity prices off the boil. The JSE below 52,000 on the all-share index. Some quite big sell-offs happening at the moment. If you look at shares like Telkom, some pretty decent-looking results. Big, juicy dividend payment. But somebody's seen something in those numbers they don't like at all and sending the share price scuttling lower. Looking forward to catching up with Graham Kerner this evening, our market commentator, as he goes deep dive into Telkom tonight as I seek to distract him from his current job. We'll also look at the Cape Storms. Of course, big fires in Gnysda over the last 48 hours or so in Plettenberg Bay. A large number of buildings and homes and businesses and properties destroyed. We'll touch base on this one in some detail this evening. We'll also talk to Warren Ingram about the cost of retirement annuities and how much you should be spending on fees. We got an email from somebody who declined to provide more detail, but claimed, and I've got no reason to doubt the veracity of the claim, that she's paying 15% on a 300 Rand direct debit every month. And you go, hold on a second. But it goes back to 2000, so it could be an old-style RA, which is still allowed to tick over. So Warren Ingram's had a good look at that. So all of that tonight here on The Money Show. But in a moment, a brand-new Director General at the National Treasury. Let's find out more.
The Money Show on
your number one news and talk station.
Tonight's Fast Fact, courtesy of MTN Business. What do Maria Ramos, Lesitja Khanyago, and Lungisa Fuzile all have in common? They all have one thing in common. Yes, they're human beings. Okay, two things in common. They breathe oxygen. Okay, three things in common. But they've got something in common beyond the obvious. What do Maria Ramos, Lesitja Khanyago, and Lungisa Fuzile all have in common? 31702-31567. Or you can tweet me at Bruce Business if you'd like to have a stab tonight to today's Fast Fact. If you think you know the answer, get in touch and let us know your answer.
Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Dondo Mokgatjane, get used to that name because he is the new Director General in the National Treasury. Thabo Leoka is economist at Argon Asset Management, and you were quite concerned on social media not so long ago, Thabo Leoka, saying, I do hope they go inside the National Treasury. I do hope they don't make a bad mistake on this bed, on this appointment. This is an important appointment. Are you satisfied with the appointment of Dondo Mokgatjane as the new Director General?
Definitely. I mean, I was hoping that they would get someone from within the Treasury, the National Treasury, and that's exactly what they did.
I mean, how big is the talent pool? How much choice was there in National Treasury, as far as you know?
Well, they have about 8 or 9 DDGs, Deputy Director Generals, all very competent. Somebody like Momo has been there for many, many years as well, over 15 years. Actually, I think closer to 20 years. Dondo has been there for 18 years, and he's not even old. So they do have a lot of people. Even at the chief director level, I know that I've also spoken about Mampo, who's the chief director. She has a PhD in economics. So they have very capable people within Treasury.
Nobody I've spoken to today, and I've tried hard, has got a bad thing to say about Dondo Mokgatjane. That makes me, as a journalist, very suspicious. Nobody's got anything bad to say about anyone. It makes me uncomfortable. So give me a sense of this guy. Who is he? What's he good at?
So he was the Deputy Director General in charge of Public Finance Division at the National Treasury. Why Dondo, I guess, stands out is that he's been there for many, many years. I think it's his first job or only job, I'm not sure, but he's been there for many, many years, and he's not 50 yet. National Treasury officials tend to not attract scandal. Somebody like also Nhlanhla Nene or even Lungisa Fuzile, who's been there for many, many years as well, didn't have a blemish. So you shouldn't be worried that there is nothing scandalous about Dondo. He is a technocrat and he's been working in National Treasury for many years.
It suggests policy continuity. He's been there for nearly two decades. He has been intimately involved with the CEO initiative on behalf of Pravin Gordhan. So business likes him. Business can do business with him.
Definitely. Business likes him. Business knows him. I think investors will be very happy with this decision because there is policy or there is continuity within National Treasury. It's also very important to have somebody who comes from within, considering that the minister and deputy minister are both new. So you want someone who has, you know, knowledge of the department and historical knowledge, somebody who also knows the personalities within National Treasury. DG is somebody who actually steers the ship. So, you know, research and all the other DDGs report to him, and he's somebody who's very responsible for many things within the National Treasury.
Do you see a change in tone or policy out of the National Treasury yet? Thabi Leokana has been under new management for 2 months.
Yeah, policy comes from the ANC, and so we will gain certainty and clarity after the policy meeting or policy conference in end of June, beginning of July. And not certainty, rather some colour, because certainty will come when that policy is endorsed in December at the ANC conference. And that policy sticks with us for the next 5 years. So I guess the National Treasury will also be waiting to see what the ANC decides in terms of policy. But as long as they don't change fiscal policy, I think the market will be very happy with that. And if they do, then it will be quite risky because we do know what we need to do in order for us to close the budget deficit.
Yeah, I mean, the finance minister has been talking about managing the deficit. He's been making all the right noises. Moody's tomorrow, they're likely to announce a downgrade of one notch. We'll still remain in investment grade if they do that. Is there any chance that they downgrade us two notches to sub-investment grade? Because then the game changes completely.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely that they downgrade us by two notches. I think that the best case scenario in this very bleak outlook is that they downgrade us by one notch, which still keeps us at investment grade. What I'm worried about is that they may stick to the negative outlook, which means that the sign or the trend is down rather than up. Regardless, we still need to work very hard because come December, we have Fitch and S&P back again. And if we haven't improved in the past 6 months or we haven't shown them that we are on our way to recovery, the risk is that they will move in the wrong direction.
Thabi Leokana, thank you for your input this evening, economist at Argon Asset Management. Andrew Donaldson on the line to us from Cape Town this evening, former Deputy Director General at the National Treasury. Arguably, we could be talking to you as the new Director General of the Department of Finance, Andrew Donaldson, but you didn't give anybody a chance to ask you. Resigned very soon after Lungisa Fuzile. Have you got resigner's remorse at all? Are you missing going to the National Treasury and dealing with the complexity of a struggle economy?
Hello, Bruce. I didn't resign. I've half retired, but I still have a part-time relationship with the Treasury.
You're sounding a bit like Brian Molefe here, Andrew Dolls.
Escape.
You're sounding.
No.
Okay, so
what? Be very clear.
No, absolutely. So you're not going to the office on a daily basis, but what are you doing for the National Treasury then?
Well, I'll continue to do some work on budgetary and public finance issues.
Okay, no, that's good to hear. Tell me about Dondo Mokgatjane, please, because you'll know him considerably better than most of us, having worked with him for much of the last 18 years.
Yes, well, he has been with the Treasury for 18 years or so, and in several capacities. Perhaps the most important of those is that for a number of years he was the Chief of Staff in the Ministry, and that's a great testing ground for anybody in the finance environment because you're the intermediary between the Ministry and the whole of Treasury and the public entities that report to the minister. So he has a very good background in the full range of things that the Treasury and the Finance Ministry are responsible for. He gets on very well with people. He's a great engager. Treasury is a disputatious environment. There are always half a dozen views on things. You've got to be able to listen. You've got to bring different parts of the Treasury together to advise the minister on issues that often affect different parts of Treasury. So I think he's the right man for the job.
I mean, that's good to hear. What can we expect in the Treasury? More of the same? I mean, again, this is the first time I think I've ever done an interview about the appointment of a Director General of the Treasury, simply because before we trusted that good decisions will be made, and there's been a lot of circumspection around the future of the National Treasury, lots of concerns around the future of the National Treasury. That's why this particular appointment is so important. And your say-so is important in this particular one, because you've worked there, you've had a credible career within the Treasury. I mean, is he going to be a civil servant who simply runs the department like a civil servant should? No fuss, no bother.
Well, there's no fuss, no bother would be nice, but it's never like that in the Treasury. A lot of people have emphasized continuity, so I think there is a sense of relief. This is somebody who's been in the Treasury for a long time, so the continuity is there. But I think we've also got to say, you know, the economy is in trouble. These are tough times. The budget's not going to be easy. There's some really difficult things before us. And so it's not just continuity. It's also about thinking out of the box, engaging with the business sector, engaging with the Reserve Bank, engaging with the international institutions. Dondo spent several years as the as one of the lead advisors with one of the Africa groups in the World Bank. So he was a treasury secondment to the World Bank for a while, so he knows the international institutions, the international environment well. But I don't think we should expect it's all going to be the same. There are tough things that have to be done to turn the economy around and keep the public finances on track.
And you say that Dondo is the guy to do it?
Yes, I think so. And I think there's a good team around him. I think that the continuity isn't just in the DG's office. You've also got a strong team in the budget office, in the public finance divisions, and in the financial management parts of the Treasury, in economic policy. So this is a team effort.
My thanks to you, Andrew Donaldson, former Deputy DG at the National Treasury. Still doing some work for National Treasury, which is good to hear. Andrew Donaldson has been a pivotal part of that National Treasury, as has the new DG, Dondo Mohajane, who gets the stamp of approval of Andrew Donaldson, also of Thabo Leoko, who's massively relieved that good sense has prevailed. There was some speculation that Brian Molefe could turn up at the National Treasury. At one point, it was as minister, and he went off to Parliament went into the waiting room in Parliament, and then was bypassed on that, then went back to Eskom, of course, and we know that he's now fighting in the Labour Court for some kind of compensation because he feels like he's been treated badly by Eskom. And then there was a little bit of a rattle saying, well, you know, he's worked in the National Treasury before. He was appointed initially by Trevor Manuel a long time ago. Perhaps he could go back there. And I think there's quite a lot of relief that we've gone for a secure, safe pair of hands in a technocrat who's going to have a big job. I've been watching recently a series called In the Thick of It, which is based loosely on Alistair Campbell, who was Tony Blair's pit bull when he was Prime Minister of the UK. And it's sort of like a 21st century version of Yes Minister. And you look at the manipulation, the politics, and the shouting that goes on, and the fighting that goes on. And I think if we knew half of what happened in government departments, especially when it comes to pushbacks against things like state capture and against the lunacy of nuclear and all of that sort of stuff, these guys have got to be tough as nails. They really do. And a lot of them are unsung heroes, quite frankly.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
So today's fast fact, what do Maria Ramos, Lesitja Khanyaho, Lungisa Fuzile, what do they all have in common? I'm surprised that some of you got it wrong, actually, because I thought it was quite an easy one. Some of you saying they all ran Transnet. I suppose Maria ran Transnet for a bit. Nope, the other two didn't. Okay, so what are we talking about this evening on 31702 31567, or you can tweet me at Bruce Business. Graham Kerner with a Kerner perspective this evening. We're below 52,000. 2 weeks ago, we were testing record levels. We were a percentage, 1.5% away from record levels, and suddenly every bit of fizz, pop, bang, and excitement has evaporated out of our market.
Oh, humbug.
Yeah, bah, humbug.
Yeah, look, it's... What's weighing on it? I think the GDP numbers. I think foreigners have been offloading SA Inc. I think if you just look today, things like Woolworths, ShopRite, the big banks, Bidvest as well. Anybody that I think is quite exposed to the consumer, people are sobering up and saying, you know what, maybe you shouldn't pay a 25 multiple for a company that operates very or is very dependent on the consumer in the kind of economy that we're in. So I think that's really what's weighing on the market. But it's done nothing for 3 years. Exactly 3 years, we've done nothing.
But you look at the numbers that came out, was it yesterday, the day before? The recession is 3 days old, so it was the day before yesterday. Time flies when you're having fun. When the growth number for the first quarter came out, and everything to do with consumer expenditure, anything to do with consumer confidence is not quite evaporated, but is certainly declining at quite an alarming rate. That's banks, that is retailers, and it's anywhere where you're going to have any fun, or maybe buy a nice sucker for after supper.
Or a luxury car.
Or a luxury car, whatever it is, those guys are really struggling.
Absolutely right. And I think cargo carriers saying basically three of their divisions battling. So you know what I find amazing? They always say, you know, it's lies, damn lies, and statistics. But the truth of it is GDP data is stale. Anybody operating in the real world selling to consumers, you know, came from a school function the other night, stopped off, grabbed a few pizzas, and the guy said, when you phoned, I thought it would be wonderful if you were ordering 20 large. Anybody exposed to the consumer is really battling. And it's not news. The statistic really just affirms what a lot of people know. But, you know, again, our job as investors is to sort of critically assess what we buy and quite importantly, what we pay. Because if you bought a share three years ago and it was, you know, you paid 100 Rand and it's still 100 Rand, you know, you've only really generated the dividend yield, which probably on average is, you know, 2.5%, 3.5%. You could have done better in cash.
But you've had inflation over that time of 6% a year. And so actually, you're down, the 100 Rand that you spent on that share is worth 82 Rand today in money that's 3 years old.
Yeah, absolutely right. But the other important thing is that when you look at the top 40, it's obviously moved around with some volatility over 3 years, but not much. And it's been this push-pull factor, where, you know, things like Naspers or let's say Naspers or British American Tobacco have done really well, but lots of other companies that have done abysmally. And I think the other important thing, if you look at the banks today, for example, at 140 odd Rand for Barclays Africa and Standard Bank, you know, there were times when Nenegate, where you could have bought them
80, 70.
Yeah, well, maybe a little bit more than that. But there were opportunities to pay sensible prices where you would have locked in great dividend yields and actually generated some sort of performance.
Just explain that to me, because that's such an important point. If you lock in a great dividend yield, so you buy, if you buy a company at for 120 Rand and it pays you 10 Rand a year dividend, that's you get 10 Rand a year, it takes you 12 years to really get the value of the share back. If the share price had fallen to 80 Rand and you pay 10 Rand, it would only take you 8 years to earn that share.
Yeah, and if you look at the dividend, you know, if they were paying you 5 Rand on your 100 Rand, if you paid 70 Rand for that rather than the 100, your running dividend yield is a whole lot better. And I think a lot of people in markets say, oh, you know, it's time in the markets, not timing the markets. And yeah, on a 20-year view or a 15-year view, that's right.
Take a 3-year view, there's nothing happening.
Absolutely. And you've got to be, and that's, I think, the what I'm trying to say is, for a long time, the South African retailers were running on fumes to a large extent.
Yeah. And hope.
And hope. and the bottom line is that where these things were trading in mid-20 PEs, delivering reasonable earnings growth, but, you know, there were storm clouds on the horizon. People who were buying retailers maybe 2 or 3 years ago, you know, they're going to probably regret it for some time, because this consumer environment is not going to resolve itself, because, you know, the political issue and everything we hear about all day on radio is not going to resolve itself at least until the end of December.
No, exactly right. Quick one on Telkom. Any idea why it's looks like it's fallen out the window, down 15% in 3 days after ostensibly fairly decent results?
Look, I don't follow them very, very closely, but I think it's gravity taking over. It had a phenomenal run. Yeah, well, I think the normalized the revenue was up, about 8%. Earnings were up, but that's on the headline one. When you actually looked at the basic earnings, they were basically flat. So Telkom Mobile's looking a lot better. Lots of fiber into homes, but that therein, I think, is what's bugging the market. fiber is basically disruptive technology.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that you're putting the fiber in, but that's coming at the expense of the ADSL, which is both line and voice. And I think that's the reality. The cell phone and all the telecoms companies are basically almost, it's like a beast that's consuming itself.
A friend of mine today who happens to live in Parkhurst, which is the independent republic of, in terms of telecommunications.
Like Hout Bay.
Hout Bay, I don't think, is off the grid in terms of telecommunications. Not on purpose, anyway. They took themselves off the grid. They've got fiber to the home. He's signed up with Cell C. They do WhatsApp phone calls. And when he's at home on his network, he's using WhatsApp on his cell phone to make phone calls for nothing.
Absolutely right. So somebody, I take myself, you know, what I spent on telecom and internet connections and cell phones, you know, maybe even 2 years ago, and what I'm paying now is probably, it's halved. And the fiber is more reliable, it's quicker. Mm-hmm. So all around, I think that's what's really bugging telecom. I think people initially reacted too positively, and it's really just resetting because it's not cheap.
Graham Kerner with the Kerner perspective this evening. I did ask you earlier in our Fast Fact with MTN Business. I said to you, what do the following three people have in common? Maria Ramos, Lungisa Fuzile, and Lisitja Khanyako. No, they were not all reserve bank. They were not all. Where's my favorite answer? They're Pete and Greenside. They were all in charge of the Reserve Bank. That's too general, Peter. They've kind of had connections to the Reserve Bank. Certainly, Lisitja Khanyako is in charge of the Reserve Bank. Fuzile never was, and nor was Maria. Karabo. My favorite answer is Karabo. Ramos, Khanyako, and Fuzile, all former Treasury Directors General. All three were besties of their ministers, one much more so. Oh, that's nice, Karabo. That was funny. Nicely. Well done. So, yes, the fast fact is that they've all been Directors General in the National Treasury. Why did I ask you that? Well, the fact is that there is a new Director General in town. The confirmation that 20-year Treasury veteran Dondo Mokgatjane is DG number 4 of our modern democracy. So well done to all of you who got that right. Lots of you did, including you, Thomas Palandwa, this evening as well. Here we're on some more fast facts about MTN Business. They do understand the importance of protecting what helps your business grow. They've got cyber security initiatives, they do vulnerability assessments, IT network security, email security, firewalls, and mobile device security. So to protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. If you know your fast facts, remember, join me for the MTN Biz Quiz tomorrow, where I've got 2,000 Rand in cash to give away to the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
SMS Bruce on 3.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Insurers live in dread of the impact of extreme weather. The devastating fires in the Southern Cape, one example. There was a fair amount of damage also as a result of Wednesday's Cape storm. Denise Shaw is Chief Operating Officer at Standard Insurance. It's part of Standard Bank Group. Have you got lots of clients down there, Denise?
Yes, we do, Bruce. Thank you for listening to me to this evening. We've got in excess of 1,500 customers in that region.
Is it more serious? Is the damage that you're seeing, the sort of reports that you're getting out of NYSDA, Plett, that part of the world, more serious than the St. Francis fires of a couple of years ago?
Absolutely, and I think it's the extent of the fires that we've seen, and understandably here we have tragedy where life and properties are lost, and clearly this is hugely devastating for our customers and for South Africans that are going through this particular event.
Okay, I mean, in terms of the quantum of losses, though, do you anticipate that the fires that we've seen in the Southern Cape will be more than the St. Francis fires? Because those were significant and led to some fairly significant impacts, profitability impacts, on South African insurance companies.
Absolutely, Bruce. It's a very early day still, and it's difficult to come to some sort of quantum. But certainly from a Standard Bank perspective, we've seen this as being a much larger than what we saw in St. Francis.
When it comes like the claims for personal effects, they're claims for homes, but there's a lot of business damage, a hospital caught fire, an old age home caught fire. There was extensive damage to forests and to farmland as well, I suspect.
Yes, it's very widespread across most categories.
Okay, so, I mean, when you look at it, and also, is it possible? I look at an area like NYSDA, picturesque, absolutely lush green beauty, and so much of the town has been damaged by fire. The forests around have been damaged by fire. For an industry, for a town so dependent on tourism, is it possible to insure against losing business if visitor numbers drop in the next holiday season, two or three?
Yes, you can insure for that, Bruce, absolutely. There are certain commercial entities that have for business interruption insurance, so that definitely is an opportunity for customers.
But, I mean, those sort of premiums would be pretty hefty. I can't imagine that too many people would have insured against the specifics of something as dramatic as a once-in-a-lifetime fire like this.
Yes, it depends. Most of the time it is for smaller storm-related devastations, not always particularly for fires, but clearly that is also covered in this event.
What about acts of God? I mean, insurers are notorious for, I mean, forgive me, Person Company accepted, I'm sure, Denise, but insurers are very good at making contracts absolutely foolproof. I mean, do you have a get-out-of-jail-free card as a result of an act of God when it comes to something as cataclysmic as we've seen over the last couple of days in NYSDA?
Not at all, Bruce. That is exactly what we are here for, and we certainly cover the acts of God. So storm, lightning, what we've seen in terms of fire, absolutely, that's what we are here for.
What happens in the case of the unthinkable happening, as has happened in the Southern Cape? I mean, what does it do to premiums of people in Gauteng? Does it change an industry's approach to the way in which it calculates risk? Suddenly, something unprecedented happens, and everybody goes, oh, hold on a second, we hadn't ever considered that. Perhaps we should put premiums up across the board. I mean, are we likely to see a shift in premiums as a result of this?
I certainly don't believe that, Bruce. We're very resilient industry as well, and maybe to just expand a little bit, in situations like that, the extent of the damage that we cover as insurance companies also becomes an international event. What I mean is that there are reinsurers that also carry some of this risk.
So, I mean, explain this to me, please, if you would, Denise, because you're an insurance company, but you buy insurance from other insurance companies to cover you just in case you've got too many claims, as you might have in this particular case.
Absolutely. Just like we, as individuals, would carry an excess for claims that we would claim for, exactly the same way the insurance companies also would on part that risk, but there is an excess that insurance companies would carry for the first whatever millions of rands.
And what about the Cape storm itself? I mean, we're focusing a lot on the devastation caused by the huge fires in the Southern Cape. The Cape storm itself was reputed to be the biggest in 30 years. It came and it went. It did quite a lot of damage and then moved on. But I don't think it was nearly as devastating as had been feared.
Certainly from a Standard Bank perspective, we have seen a tremendous amount of claims surpassed. So much more than we have seen on the fire side.
Really?
But as I said to you, Bruce, it's early days, and what we are trying to do is phone customers proactively, actually getting in contact with customers before they actually get hold of us, so that we can try and manage and let customers know that we are there for them, that we can assist them, especially at the moment with alternate accommodation, especially where homes have actually burned to the ground and people don't have a roof over their heads.
I mean, do you find, Denise, at a time like this, that people suddenly start taking an interest in the small print, whereas people will sign up for their insurance in the hope that they'll be sorted out, they'll be covered, there may be a roof over their heads in the event of their house burning down? But it just highlights to my mind the importance of really understanding what it is that you've bought and really understanding as much of the detail as you can and refreshing all of that detail on a regular basis, because, boy, we forget fast.
Yes, I do believe there's an element of that, but it's also the onus on insurance companies, especially during these times, that we actually go out and we tell people that we are there for them, that we want them to contact us, and that we want to support them in whatever manner we can to see them through, especially these traumatic times.
Denise Shaw, Chief Operating Officer at Standard Insurance, part of the Standard Bank Group. Thank you. Lots of insurers are going to be doing their sums now, and they're going to be looking at those two parts of the world which have been hit in different ways by adverse weather conditions, devastating fires in the Southern Cape, some very dangerous storms in the Western Cape as well. And yeah, that weather-related damage is a big cost center for insurance companies. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. Somebody goes by the name of Boom Boom on Twitter tells me this evening that they went to Spa. They wanted to buy a 2-liter liquid. Fruit, but it cost $40. So they looked at the Iron Brew, 2.5 liters, for 13 rand. So they bought the Iron Brew, which is their favorite anyway, but they wanted to buy the juice and decided not to. Is liquid fruit that expensive? $40 for 2 liters. seems pricey. But again, people are making different consumer choices. And that's what it refers to, an earlier conversation around inflation, around the cost of food, around the cost of your grocery basket, and people making alternative choices when it comes to pricey products.
The Money Show, FAQs.
FAQ today is about how you can help in the Southern Cape in particular. And a number of companies have come to the party. I saw APSA coming out with a 10 million rand donation. I've seen other companies, DHL, getting involved in logistics, Pick and Pay, donating some money, making its stores available as drop-off sites for aid. Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman is founder and chairman of Gift of the Givers. And as always, Imtiaz, you're getting right into the thick of it and getting involved. Tell me what your people on the ground in the Southern Cape are telling you about the extent of the damage and the devastation in that part of the world.
Hi, Bruce. What you're seeing on TV, what the pictures you're getting on social media, that's exactly what they're saying. They're saying the destruction is huge, but more than that, if we get the feedback from the people themselves, they live in the area, they know what it's been like before the fire, and they now know what is after the fire. And I think the most chilling words all of them have said is, Nizhna has burned to the ground. To us, that is the most devastating statement you've heard, because that kind of comment you normally hear in war situations, where a city or a town is completely flattened to the ground during war. And the feedback we got from people who were anxious, the hysteria in their voice, when pets were missing, when family people were missing, and the fire was coming to their homes, and they were waiting and trying to get hold of emergency services, and you know they couldn't get through. And with so many calls. And it's those kind of stories that tell us the psychological, the emotional aspect of the fire itself. Yes, the physical destruction is there. It's huge and massive. But the physical destruction leaves a lasting memory on the emotional aspect of the people.
Absolutely. And so much of what has been lost can be insured and has been insured. And so public property will be insured, and that'll be positive. There are lots of wealthier people in Nizhna who will be insured. But there are also a whole bunch of people who are not going to be covered, who are not going to be insured. The Cape Storms, for example, lots of shacks blew over. Lots of people left homeless as a result of these adverse weather conditions. And that is the space into which you fit very, very neatly.
Hello.
Yeah, Imtiaz, you with us?
I've lost you.
Oh, no, we've got you, Imtiaz. I don't know if you can hear me. Let's try one more time. I mean,
I can hear you now. You said something about rich can afford properties and some people.
No, the rich people may be insured and can mitigate some of the financial devastation, but there are poorer people in communities, Imtiaz, who are going to be left absolutely destitute, and that's where your primary focus must be, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. You know, for a poor person to lose one suitcase is like losing a whole life's earnings. That's, you know, because people cherish what they have. Many people take them many years to even buy one sofa chair or a lounge suite or a fridge. And if people have lost that, in this lifetime, some of them will never be able to replace that. It sounds quite ridiculous, but that is the stark reality of the economic situations of many people.
Sure.
And people like those are dependent on the donors that phone to your show, or, you know, call into your radio program or listen to your program. Those donations make an enormous difference to the lives of these people. And sometimes you go the little extra mile. If he had one sofa, maybe he'll be lucky. He'll get two.
Yeah.
If he had two shirts in his cupboard, he may have four now. So sometimes, you know, it benefits them slightly more, but it's, you know, they've been waiting for a lifetime for something to happen to them. And sometimes it happens after a major destruction like this.
Imtiaz, our FAQ, our frequently asked question tonight is, how can people help? How do they get access to, if they want a credible way of helping out in the devastation that has played out in the last 48 hours, how do they get hold of you?
It's simple. 0800-786-911 or visit www.giftofthegivers.org. You know, there's two ways. One is items in kind. The others are cash contributions. The items in kind will be used for simple relief, the blankets, the food, the bottled water, the dry type of food, diapers, sanitary pads, things like that. And the cash funds will be used for the kind of things that you're mentioning. So those people who've lost everything, maybe it will reimburse them, replace the items, and give them a slightly better quality of life.
Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman doing incredible work abroad, but also at home in times of crisis. Founder and chairman of Gift of the Givers, diverting resources that were en route to Cape Town, judging the emergency and sending some of those resources to the Southern Cape. Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, thank you very much. Giftofthegivers.org is your best bet. It's the easiest one to remember if you'd like to make contributions to the relief efforts in both the Western and Southern Cape. The Money Show brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. Now, I want to say, for the record, that Warren Ingram and I usually get on rather well, although he's got a bone to pick with me this evening, and we're going to have to settle this using the medium of social media. He's bought a very manly, outdoorsy jacket, and I'm curious. He denies it is the color I suggest it is. So what I've done is I've posted a picture on social media this evening, and I would like you to go to my Twitter feed and just give me a little feedback as to what color you think the jacket this manly man is wearing this evening. I've posted the picture. It's there for you to decide. I'm in the pink this evening. I wonder if you are too.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Real men wear pink. Sandile in Roodepoort, you're going to be a man after Warren Ingram's own heart, I think, Sandile. Please tell me a wonderful cheapskate story.
The man who bought a 2-liter drink for 40 rand and had to buy iron brew.
Yep.
I had a similar experience today. I had to buy 2 tires. Same brand, phone the manufacturer and ask them who they distribute to. The manufacturer's website had one supplier, but I knew of another guy who had the same product. So I asked the manufacturer if the guy is legit. They said yes. But the guy that the manufacturer has on their website was selling me the tire at 1,400 rands more than the other guy. So my story is guy who gave up on the juice, should have just walked out of that store and went and did a bit more research, and he would have found the juice at a reasonable price.
I suspect you're right, Sandile, and shopping around, there's a lot to be said for it. Sandile, thank you very much. Driving around Roodepoort this evening, on, you can hear these cars on new tyres. There's a new tyre rumble going, and he got a decent deal on those tyres. Oh, man, you've got to have a little bit of time on your hands, but it is so worthwhile shopping around. And in this economic climate, frankly, if you're not asking for a discount, as we were talking about last night, then you deserve to pay lots of money. Ask for the discount. It's important.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Money Show.
Last time I spoke to Leon Strumpfer, it was celebratory. It was all about classic cars. It was all about investment opportunities in classic cars. And we had a really nice chat. He is a classic car investor. He's a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. He's based in the Knysna office. Leon Strumpfer, is your office still standing?
Hi, Bruce. It's just a sad story. Our office is standing. Last night, 4 families actually slept on the floor in the office. Luckily, we have the good fortune of being on an island, which was one of the 2 sort of escape places. So Teeson Island was one and Leisure Island was the other. So a lot of families slept in their cars, brought their pets. You had sort of a mass migration onto Teeson Island and Leisure Island last night, yeah.
Okay, so the office is standing. You were able to help some people out. But, I mean, the whole region, you weren't in town last night. You must have been really concerned about it heading home today.
Yeah, sure. I landed at about 4 o'clock, drove in. We stay on a farm in Reenendal, which basically borders the perimeter on those mountains of Knysna, surrounding Knysna, and you know, I spoke to a friend of mine, and he described it exactly how it looked. He said it was like going onto the moon. It was just desolate. It was there were 2 cars burnt to the ground on the side of the road. Forests, as far as I can see, smithereens. I mean, my wife told me when I got home, my father was out fighting fires on the farm next door, and indigenous forest doesn't burn easily, especially Knysna indigenous forest. I mean, it's wet, it's hardy. It was basically incinerated by the heat of this fire, which is, yeah, very scary. That's what I can say. I mean, this thing, it's quite ominous. You had this full moon rising above the mountain line surrounding Knysna, and you had these smoldering sort of plumes. Just it looked like something like out of the apocalypse. So we're lucky. I feel very, very sorry for families that have lost everything. You know, we know of many, many homes that have burned to the ground. Probably the saddest story I've heard is a very dear client of mine who lost an entire family last night. Who stays on his property, father, mother, and daughter.
No, I mean, it's just the human tragedy around this thing, Leon, is devastating. It happened so fast.
Yeah.
There was, I mean, I think it got so big so quickly that it was become a really
so
difficult
quick.
Fire to fight. I mean, are the fires under control tonight? I mean, as you look around you...
It seems to be, yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, you're right. It seems to be. Plett are sort of in the firing line now. It seems like the fires are headed that way, unless the wind changes, but the wind's heading that way. But it looks like pretty much everything's out, but you know how smoldering logs tend to catch again. So I think everyone's on high alert, defense forces here. So everyone's, I mean, the camaraderie from a disaster is incredible. You know, just one quick story, which you'll love is, there's an old age home in Belvedere, which is one of the hardest hit areas. I mean, you're talking 70 plus age group. All of these people had to walk over the hill down onto Brenton and walk along a beach 5Ks long alongside the sea at night, arriving in Buffalo Bay. And a lot of the residents in Buffalo Bay and Sedgefield took them in. So... many families are taking in, strangers tonight and last night. So wonderful to see the human spirit sort of alive and well. Yeah.
Leon Strumpfer, thanks so much. I can hear in your voice, it's been a devastating couple of days. And the cost is yet to be calculated. The human cost, of course, people have died. That is the biggest one. Then, of course, there is the financial cost. There's the emotional damage as well. Because you live in an area like that in absolute pristine beauty, and you've got a house that's on a cliff in a forest, and you think to yourself that you've arrived, and the next thing, everything is around you is destroyed. Those forests aren't going to grow again in your lifetime, certainly not the indigenous ones. And it's going to change the way of life in that part of the world. It's going to impact tourism. It's going to impact that economy very significantly. So the consequences of these fires, beyond the short-term devastation and the fear and the uncertainty that it causes right now, is going to be felt for years to come.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
Before we get into the serious matters of personal finance, I posted a picture of Warren Ingram in his new jacket. He's been shopping, and I thought it was very pretty. And so I did ask him what color it was, and he insisted it was one particular color. I insisted it was another. And tragically, for most of you who've responded on social media, you need to get your eyes checked because you're colorblind. You are. It's not red. It's pink. It's the color of strawberry milkshake. Isn't it? Real men wear pink, Warren Ingram, and I'm very impressed by your courage, so well done. What a courageous choice. If you're not going to use it, by the way, can I have it? Because I quite like it. It's very manly. Very manly on you. Now listen, on to more serious things than the trivialities of jackets. We need a little lightening up after the seriousness of, it's EFF, says Boy to Man. Okay, which means it's red. I think that gives you cred. Red gives you credit.
Right now, I don't mind that association.
Well, there we go, because you're very fashionable. Now, on to more serious things. We often talk about costs in investing, and I got an email from Kerri-Anne, and I'm not going to mention the company, because I asked Kerri-Anne for documentation and proof of this, and she didn't provide it. Maybe she just got busy, I don't know. So I don't want to go and lambaste a single company on this particular front, based on the limited information I have. But I do need to test with you the veracity of the claim. Says Kerri-Anne, I'm having a problem with the fees for my RA. My premium is 300 Rand a month, and I haven't increased this premium since inception, which was in April 2000. But since inception of this policy, she calls it, I'm paying 45 rand a month in fees. Initially, it was 36 rand 37. It gradually increased every year until now it's close to 45 rand a month. Even though the premium has stayed the same, this is now 15% of every 300 rand I put in every month. Please help me how to address this, Carrie Ann. I mean, does that sort of fee make sense on a retirement annuity? Importantly, this one dates back to 2000.
There are a range of issues here, so I'm going to give you an answer, but I'm not going to give you one straight up. I think the first thing is we don't really like, we don't like a lack of transparency when it comes to costs. We all want to know what is the rand amount that I'm going to pay for my investment, and don't hide it somewhere. So the starting point of something like this is, she's saying, 45 rand a month is high related to the 300 rand a month debit order. But, I mean, if you said, okay, so since 2000, how many, so it's 17 years. Just to
17 times 12 is an awful lot of payments.
Okay, so I'm quickly doing that. So
thank you.
17 times 12.
It's 200
times,
or so.
Yeah, 204, you are a myths.
Hey!
Times by 300 rand. Okay, because it's 300 rand a month.
Yeah.
So it's 61,200 rand.
That she has invested, and she would have seen some capital growth over that time, but has she seen any growth at all based on the sort of fee she's
paying? Okay, so let's look at that. 61,200, and so 45 times 12 equals 540 rand a year is a fee. Now divide that by 60, what did I say? 61,000.
Yeah.
Just to give it a context. So that gets us to a fee of 0.8% per year on the value of the assets. So if we're knocking that to say, okay, 0.8% for the cost of an investment, let's relate that to the unit trust world, where if someone said to me, I've got an RA and my cost is 0.8% a year and I've got a debit order of 300 rand a month, I'd say that's not a bad cost. There'll be a few buts, because there are always going to be buts in this instance. One is, I'm not sure that, and that's why you wanted the documentation, is there also a fee on the asset management fee? So is this just an administration fee, and then there's still an assets under management fee, which I expected would be. But if we were comparing apples with apples, a unit trust company that offered an RA would charge you about 0.5% a year. That's the highest fee I've seen. And so in this context, if you say, okay, so the administration here is 0.8 versus 0.5.
Okay, so it's not a train smash, but it feels like a huge chunk of the money is going in fees. I mean, I don't get where she's paying 15% of every premium. She's paying in fees, and now you're giving me 0.8%. I don't understand the difference in that calculation. I may have been able to do the sum in my head, but this is where the financial advisor pat comes.
Yeah, so and I think this is probably the downside, of transparency, because there needs to be an account fee, and I would be saying, there must be a fixed cost to opening an account for anybody. There's going to be, you have to pay the FSB to have a life assurance license, which you need for an RA. I know it sounds funny because one's an investment, but that's the law. Then you need to run those accounts, run bank accounts, all of that stuff. That's going to have a cost, and I think if you say to someone that it costs us 45 rand a month to open the account. In the stockbroking world, for example, that's really where they've gone. They've gone away from percentage fees to run a stockbroking account, and they've said, whether you've got 1 cent, 1 million rand, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It costs us X amount to open this account and to manage it for you and to give you your tax reporting, et cetera, et cetera. Ironically, in the stockbroking world, those accounts cost you somewhere around 45 or 50 bucks a month. So now I'm looking at it and saying, it's high, but at the same time, you actually can't go into the unit trust world, for example, and get in most of these companies won't give you an RA for 300 rand a month.
Yeah, but okay, so how are you actually meant to get ahead when you're paying such a high fee?
Because that fee is 45 rand a month, and you're only relating it to the debit order.
Yeah.
So remember, the debit order adds to itself.
I am.
And it adds to itself again.
It does. Okay.
So every year, you end up with whatever it is.
No, fair enough. I understand, but it still feels high. It still upsets me.
And I think that so that part I agree with. So what I'm saying is it's 0.8% versus 0.5 in just in the one context. It feels high to me, and you would think that if it's a big insurance company, they must have critical mass. They could probably do it a bit cheaper.
When are we going to get more clarity on pricing? Because I mean, there's so much argument around RDR, Retail Distribution Review, TCF, treating customers fairly, and all of these sorts of little clues as to better treatment of investors and clients into the future, and yet it seems to be very, very sluggish and slow.
I think, and I can't say that I know this for a fact. I mean, we know the last deadline we were given by the FSB, and it was a hard deadline, was 1 May. That's come and gone.
That's whooshed past.
So I'm not quite sure. But what I do know is, what I believe is that we've got major conflicts and vested interests is really what I want to say, not conflicts, vested interests arguing against each other here. So you've got the, you know, I think the big insurance companies arguing for one form of RDR that I think really suits their business model. And then you've got, you know, my sort of side of the industry, the independent, saying, no, you can't do that. And I think you've now got the regulators in the middle trying to come up with the best solution for the client in this instance. And that really must be what's right for the client. But I mean, that must be the overwhelming major fact here. At the end of this whole process, the client must win. But
I would like a statement at the end of the year. Is this unreasonable? That says at the beginning of the year, you had a balance of 1,000. At the end of the year, you've got a balance of 1,100. It has cost you this year 100 rand to manage this account. You've paid your financial advisor, we've paid the broker, we've paid all of the fees. So you would have had 1,200. We kept 100. We gave you 100. So now you've got 1,100. And now you start the new year with 1,100. And at the end of next year, I want to see if I've got 1,200 and how much I paid in fees in total. Really simple, really clear. Don't obfuscate. Don't fudge. Don't lie. Don't hide. Why is it so hard to deliver?
I think because of the vested interests. So I'll give you an example. In the unit trust world, when you get your statement, if I'm your advisor, and it's on most of I think pretty much they have to be on all of the unit trust companies, you'll see my fee as a rand amount. What you won't see is the unit trust cost as a rand amount. They'll tell you it's a percentage. Yeah. And it's frankly not necessarily in their interests, I think, to show you those costs, because suddenly
you might get a fright.
You'll quantify that and now as a rand amount. And what I've realized is most of us don't understand percentages. We don't do them. We don't sit down with a calculator and work them out.
No.
And so we'll say to ourselves, like I've done now, okay, so that's 0.5 versus 0.8. You know,
it's not a train smash.
It's not a train smash until you now get it to a rand amount. And then you start to say, well, now I want to ask more questions. Why? What value am I getting? So I think your request, if we said by the end of the year that's reasonable, I think it is reasonable. And the only thing I would ask for is that everybody's fees are shown exactly the same.
Why can the regulator not demand that?
I think they should, but I think that's where the vested interests kick in again, is because, you know, someone will say, hang on, but if we do show that, then, you know, then people, the low income will now be unadvised. That seems to be one of the very big arguments now, and you know, we're going to, if we look at the UK, we're going to lose a whole lot of advisors, and the country can't afford to not have advisors, and I think that there's merit.
You and I were at the same conference the other day, a financial planning conference, in which it became very clear that we have a far higher proportion of financial advisors in South Africa per head of the population than the United Kingdom does.
Yes, I think the one piece of information there that I think they should have said was let's look at properly qualified real advisors as opposed to
brokers,
salespeople,
yeah.
And I think then the market would look radically different. And I think that's the difference here. We have, but I think, you know, included in that number would be, you know, people who sell funeral policies, et cetera. And with respect to most of the people who sell funeral policies, they haven't really got a qualification in financial advice at all. And so
okay,
that's
so is there the foolproof idiot's guide that Bruce can understand that tells me what I'm actually paying for an investment in a market that in 3 years has gone nowhere? I've paid an awful lot of fees on a retirement annuity, for argument's sake.
The answer is I don't think so. I think you're going to have to do some sums yourself, and you're going to have to get through just understand all those layers of costs. And you can get them if you ask for them. And you were talking earlier about shopping around, and this is in one instance where you do need to be a little bit ballsy about this and actually push back to the product providers.
And what if you'd say, I don't know, hypothetically, you'd made 5 payments into a retirement annuity product, and this year you decided you weren't going to, and the person who sold you the retirement annuity, you haven't spoken to them for the last 18 months, but they're still taking 1% of the value of your investment as a fee every year.
So
that might make one grumpy.
It can and it should make you grumpy. I mean, I think the point is you're paying for quality advice, And you know, you should be speaking to your advisor at least once, and I think probably twice a year as a minimum. And you need to understand why things haven't gone anywhere, etc. And if you're not getting that, then the point is what you're paying for, you're not receiving. You know, you are paying for advice. You should be. The law requires you to actually be spoken to at least once a year. You know, whether it's by email or phone call or meeting, doesn't matter. You know, proactive conversation and sending the person a statement doesn't count. And so I agree with you. And my issue is that, you know, again, in the insurance company space, you know, you get sold an RA and then you might not actually know exactly what the fees are, et cetera, et cetera. In the unit trust world, you could fire your advisor as the answer and say, hang on, I haven't seen you, get out of here, and your fees drop. So if you've got a unit trust RA, my advice is, if your advisor is not making contact with you in the last 12 months, fire them and reduce your fee.
If this does nothing else, this program this evening, it must make you a more bullshit consumer of financial products. You've got a right to know what you're paying. You've got a right to know all of the costs that you're paying. And don't take for granted a thing called a total expense ratio, because it's not a total expense ratio. It's a percentage of part of the costs.
And again, then ask for the explanation in rand terms. So please calculate that for me eventually in rands. And my last comment there is, that you need to know three things. What's the advice fee then in rands? What's the administration fee in rands? And then what's my actual investment management cost, my unit trust cost or whatever in rands? Tell me what that is. All three, Laz. Don't tell me the one bit, because that's what I'm seeing at the moment. The insurance advisors are saying, no, your cost is 0.5% here. Well, actually, no, that's just to pay the advisor. That's not to pay the insurance company and the fund costs.
How do I know if it's too much?
My guide will always be somewhere in the region of, let's just say 2.5% to 3% is the top end of all of those layers of costs. That's the maximum that you should be paying. Obviously, it's ideal to pay less, but you know, there are going to be factors that kick into that. But to me, if you're paying more than 3% a year, you're paying too much.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator with us this evening, the small business feature brought to you by the leaders in small and medium business. Telkom tomorrow starts today. Why do you look so grumpy?
Oh, Bruce, you know,
the Warren Ingram pink jacket would cheer you up.
His pink jacket didn't cheer me up.
Is it pink or is it red?
It's without a doubt it's pink. Without a doubt.
Yeah, look, I think it's I'm going to take his word for it. It's red. Because otherwise he might not come back. And he's a nice guy and stuff. All right, sorry. Why are you so grumpy?
Well, I'm grumpy about the fact that we seem, as a country, as people living in this country right now, to almost be a little bit like deers in headlights.
Uh-huh.
And we're waiting for something to happen, and we're waiting for something to change, instead of we ourselves acting to move out of the path of inevitable danger. And Bruce, what inspired this is, over the last 2 weeks, the number of meetings that I've had with business owners who have shared their stories with me, dating back 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. In some instances, people who I met 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. We had decided then on a course of action. We agreed then that course of action would have been the right course of action to take. And 3, 4, 5 years later, no action was taken at all. And there's nothing more frustrating, Bruce, than working with business owners who've got really good technical skills in critical areas of our economy, who are wrapped up in businesses that are 3, 6, 9 months away now from falling off the edge of the cliff. And recovering a business when it's that close to the edge of the cliff is an incredibly hard thing to do.
What sort of reasons do you get from the people that you've spoken to 5 years ago who haven't implemented, and if they had implemented, would be better off today than they are?
Well, I suppose, you know, it's never crystal clear as to why people didn't. So, for example, in the one business, it's a family business. They're involved in a critical industry for us, you know, the IPAP documents, the Industrial Policy Action Plan,
mm-hmm.
that's been written up by the DTI. And it's actually quite a good document.
Yeah.
It's well thought through. It's focusing on trying to create expertise within South Africa around key sectors that are job generative, but also put us in a very interesting position globally. How well it's being implemented is a separate issue, but the document itself is good. And this particular business relies on core skills in leather stitching and leather work. So it's about tanning leather, it's about building leather products, and these products are world-class products. This particular business has been around for 40, 50 years. It's inspired on a world-class design standard. It has all the potential for export in a weak rand environment into hard currency environments. And the environment over there is one wherein which it's a family business. And the successor, who has recently taken over in full, having lost his father, sadly, in the last couple of years, or in the last year or so, now wants to make the changes that should have been made 4 years ago. And unfortunately, that business model is no longer relevant in this world as it stands today, right now. And Bruce, the rate of change is massive. It's fast.
The trouble with family businesses, though, is so often the matriarch or the patriarch in the family business has got a fixed way of doing things. The person taking over may be respectful of the success of this individual who's built up a great business. And perhaps it's just not a fight that they're willing to have as they see their parent getting older, and they don't want to stress them out. They don't want to have the fight. It's working. It's fine. The cash flows are fine. It's okay. One day when I'm running it independently, I can sort this out.
You know, the problem is, though, I can completely understand that level of respect. I can completely understand the dignity that you want to maintain, the good family relationships you want to maintain. But the thing is, as we all get older, the quality of our decisions start to take a different form. We start to focus on different things as opposed to perhaps what's good for the business. It's about more what's comfortable for us and ourselves. And a business doesn't care about that. The business environment doesn't care about that. Competitors don't care about that. Changes in customer behavior don't care about that. So this issue of a son or daughter working in a family business, you as the son or daughter ought to consider, here you are in the prime of your commercial life, working in a business model that was suitable to perhaps the environment 20, 25, 30 years ago, knowing full well that this is not working.
But that's where family businesses often fail, is because you have this collision of ideas. Call it collision of egos. Call it collision of generations. Call it the generation gap that nobody can bridge, because you've got a young person with bright ideas. The father says, but I tried that 15 years ago. It doesn't work. We've got a recipe that works. Don't rock the boat. We make, you know, we're getting returns of 15% a year. Why do you want to change things? And the young person is frustrated, and they want to, but they are encumbered. They don't have the authority and the power within the business to make those changes. And that's a big problem.
And there in itself is inaction, because that particular approach is one that says, I cannot act. And when you cannot act, you feel a victim. And when you feel a victim, it perpetuates the environment of you feeling like a victim. And Bruce, as I said, a business doesn't care about that. It's an independent organ. It lives on its own. Mm-hmm. And it lives within the context of an environment. So whilst you having this mini crisis and pity party in your head, the business itself is taking the pain.
Yeah.
And if it takes too much pain, it's like a body that's been broken in too many places. It cannot rebuild itself.
Paolo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator this evening. How do you avoid inaction? Again, I just want to try and summarize it then. I mean, time moves on. You're in a business that is built on ego in many respects. There is the sense that you don't want to disrespect the elder person in the business. But if you don't deal with it quickly, and if you don't take control of what you can control in that business to evolve it, the asset of value that you keep talking about is not going to be an asset of nearly the same value by the time you get to take it over.
So there comes
the fight with having.
No, it is. It is a fight with having, but the fight begins first with yourself before anyone else. And in that sense, you've got to realize a couple of things. In the first instance, and this is true for all of us, whoever we may be, there are three things that make up your consciousness in life. The first thing is, you know what you know. The second thing is, hopefully you know what you don't know. But the largest part of our consciousness, Bruce, the largest part of our, let's call it awareness or existence in life, is that we don't know what we don't know. And recognizing that is one of the best ways to start addressing your ego. And recognizing that, and in fact, this whole notion was coined very, very aptly by Carl Gustav Jung, who I speak about quite frequently. He's a psychologist who tutored under Freud. And had a very good insight into the psyche of the human being, how we behave. And he turned around and he said, one of the most precious things that you can always have in your life through an attitude that you choose to hold is the precious gift of doubt. If you go about doing your daily business knowing full well that what you're doing is not the exact right action at that point in time, that little bit of doubt, that gift of doubt, makes you consider different ways of doing things all
but
the time.
But that same doubt can be crippling.
It can be crippling depending on how you go about acting on it.
Let's talk about that in a second. Pavlo Fatidis in studio from Auric Business Accelerator.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. Right, how do we get out of inaction and into action? Because without action, we are in this gradual, slow, ever speeding up descent to oblivion, business oblivion. Which is not a good place to go.
No, it's not a good place to go. So there are a couple of things. The first thing is, you need to know that perhaps the action you're about to take is not the absolute best right action. So on that basis, Bruce, act slowly, but act. In other words, don't jump off a 5-meter height, jump off a 50-centimeter height. See how you land. Did it feel good? Did it feel right? Did it improve the environment you're in? If it did, take it from 50 centimeters to a meter, and you gradually move towards taking the big steps. When it comes to, for example, changing the direction of the business, if you're going to do so with customers. Don't do so with some idea in your head that you absolutely believe through ego and through this process of projection, saying, I'm the technical expert in my particular business. This is what the market needs because the products that we have don't have features that people are responding to, et cetera, et cetera. That whole argument is tautologous. It does not go to the crux of why people aren't supporting the business on an ongoing business basis. The thing that goes to the crux there is that those people's environments have changed and therefore their problems have changed. And if you're going to look at the product to save the business as opposed to your customers to save the business, that in itself is going to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. So when you take those small steps, do so with 2 or 3 trusted customers and ask 1,000 questions instead of putting 1,000 reasons why this next improvement in the product is going to save the business.
Okay, so that's good. I'm getting, again, at what point does it become self-defeating to get too many opinions? Because your customers are struggling to move your product. You go to your customers, you tell them how you want to improve it, and they give you 3 different ideas on how to do it. They're three ideas that are fundamentally different, and you don't like any of them. And you get yourself back in that uncertainty trap once again.
Well, you know, it depends how you go about asking questions, because mostly from what I've witnessed, when people go and speak to their customers, they talk about their product or their service. They talk about the features that they're introducing. You know, here's a novel thought. How about creating a list of questions for a customer that instead of asking a customer why they buy from you, ask them instead, why do they have to buy from you? Ask them instead, why would they want to buy from you? Mm. Because it starts digging into a different level of engagement with the customer. And Bruce, so long as you're not trying to serve a multitude of different types of customers, you're going to start getting a consistent message coming through. And that becomes extremely valuable. But it requires you then to have a very particular approach to how you build that business as well.
What are they call something the silent killers of a business. What are those silent killers? Inaction is clearly a silent
killer. Inaction is as a result of one of the silent killers at work. So one of them is comfort. You know, when you're in a situation and you feel comfortable with your lot, well, while you're feeling comfortable with your lot, if your business is not growing, it's dying because someone else is growing into your customer base or growing a competing business in and around you. So comfort in itself is a silent killer. The next thing is complacency. You know, when you won't have that discussion with someone in your staff or your business partner because it's going to result in some level of conflict and you just don't feel like that conflict. You've had enough of this conflict. When you don't have conflict and you aren't able to manage a discussion that is going to engage conflict, especially between business partners and even more so in a family environment, then the discussion never takes place that yields different outcomes.
And the train smash is inevitable. Mm. I mean, you just look at high profile relationships that have imploded in recent years. And it's just often people who started out as good friends and trusted and holidays together and just, you know, in each other's back pockets all the time. Suddenly something changes in the relationship and nobody feels comfortable raising it. And it becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy that by the time somebody raises the debate, it unleashes a spark that is very often so volatile you can't pull it out.
It's so volatile and either destroys the partnership or puts a business under tremendous pressure. And then the last of the silent killers, Bruce, is blame. So right now, let's blame government.
The economy.
Let's blame the economy. Let's blame certain individuals. You know, let's blame absolutely everybody other than ourselves. Because the harsh thing about building your own business is that the only person who can be blamed ever, both for its success and its failure, is yourself. So there's a huge amount of self-reflection that's needed over here. And it should be incumbent upon you to surround yourself with good company, and to surround yourself with people who are diverse in their thinking.
What's good company? I mean, explain that. Because, I mean, often entrepreneurs are quite lonely people because they're so busy building the business. They're so busy focusing on it. They might not have taken a partner into the business. They don't have necessarily a like-minded individual in the business. It's not a big enough business necessarily to have its own board. You don't have your prefect from school as your chairman, who's your sounding board and always has been. You're just sweating every day and nobody understands your troubles because the people who are working with you just care about the salary at the end of the month and they're just there for the job and you're there for the business. And that sort of conversation again goes around in circles.
It really does. And no one wants to have an argument with you because if you are the employer and they're the employees, well, perhaps there are a couple of things. Perhaps you haven't created the right environment for them to have a good conversation with you. Perhaps they don't even really understand the purpose of the business. They don't understand the vision behind the business. So anything that they do suggest that's not aligned to that will aggravate you, and that aggravation then shuts them down further. And I think it's incumbent on every single business owner to find a person, two, maybe three. It could be a coach, it could be a mentor, it could be a friend, it could be your accountant, it could be someone out there who's not you, that has a different view and a different take, and you've got to learn.
Somebody who can tell you the truth.
Someone who can take you on what's called the desert drive. Put you in the car and drive you into the desert and say, this is my 5 cents, and you will keep quiet whilst I talk, and you will listen whilst I talk. And you may not like it, but listen to it in any event. There's nothing more healthy than that. It's hard. It's hard taking criticism as a business owner.
Have you had somebody do that to you, take you out into the desert?
I've got two desert drivers. They keep me very, very sane. And you know the most wonderful thing about them?
Did you choose them or did they choose you?
It's their relationships that formed over time. Okay. They're full of conflict. They're fraught with very difficult conversations. I don't enjoy my occasions with them at all, but I cherish each and every one of them. It allows me to get my ideas out of my head, hear myself talk about my own business, and it allows me to point out to myself where I'm flawed in my thinking and where I'm right-minded in my thinking.
I love that idea of the desert driver. Pavlo, what a nice way to end. Mm. Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. I want to know who the desert drivers are. They're like the dark riders but scarier. Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator.